It's great to be back again, and thank you for joining us on this episode of B2B Uncovered, where we get to learn from experts in marketing, growth, and sales. So today, we get to talk about product positioning, how to nail it so that customers get it, buy it, and love it. Now, quick confession, I borrowed that tagline from the book called Obviously Awesome by April Dunford, which, by the way, I would recommend. It's a very useful step-by-step guide on actually tells you how to do positioning rather than just talking about it. But to help me peel back the layers on positioning, I have here today as my guest, Jamie Barnett, who's an advisor and board member to high-tech startups and has led marketing, product, and customer success at cybersecurity, AI, DevOps, and IoT startups. So welcome, Jamie.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here. This is very fun.
Excellent. So before we dive in, could I ask you to add a little bit of meat to the bone, as we say here in England, and give us a little bit more information on your background?
Sure. Well, you know, I grew up in investment banking, out of college, helping companies, do financings and complete transactions like mergers and acquisitions. And it was just a great foundation, great way to learn about how companies work, apply a financial lens to really kind of anything that you think about, any kind of business problem, really sort of understanding the nuts and bolts of how business works. And so, it was a great foundation for me, but also great to learn what I absolutely do not want to do. I do not want to be an opinion seller. I do not want to sleep under my desk, with my pillow and sleeping bag, because it's crazy hours. And so I use that as an opportunity to really kind of hone what I do want to do, which was work with technology companies.
That's fantastic. And when did you work that out? You're in finance, and obviously that's got a particular culture and work ethic to it. When did you think, actually, I'm going to jump ship and get into technology?
Well, that was, pretty early on, looking at some of the tech companies that we were working with from a financing standpoint.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. And so I used my business school time as sort of that time off to make that transition. It was the best thing I did.
And you were at Stanford?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, good. So why don't we just, so that everybody's on the same page, if you ask 10 people definition of X, you get 10. Why don't you kick off?
And I'll add an 11th.
Yeah, give us an 11th. What's your definition of positioning?
Excellent. So, it's the foundation of everything you do as a business. I like to think of it as not just your operating system, but the kernel of your operating system, the unique space that you occupy in your market. Also, it incorporates your unique vantage point, so kind of your view of the world. And I think a really important aspect of it is what you are not. And I can take you through kind of the way that I at least come up with it, and the way that I articulate it, but I'm happy to stop there.
Yeah, no, we'll definitely dive into that. I think that's really important, isn't it? It's because otherwise you become all things to all men, and that is a recipe for disaster. Okay, so we are going to peel back there, so we're going to get our hands dirty on this. But before we do that, let me just ask you a question. Has positioning got a perception problem with marketeers? It's not cool, it's not trendy, it's sort of it's a bit boring, and let's do something a bit more sexier. What's your thoughts?
Well, I would say that it's not exactly a perception problem. I just think it's sometimes not clear and not understood and not agreed upon. And I can tell you, and I'm sure you do this too, if you go on somebody, even just as somebody going on somebody's website for the very first time, you can tell if they've got their positioning nailed or not. If they don't, it just feels sort of herky jerky. You don't feel that through line of, we know who we are. I think sometimes this is actually an executive problem. When you have maybe a CEO or an executive team who doesn't quite feel confident that they, feel confident in kind of how they're describing themselves, how they're positioned. And so, you know, company will go through a positioning exercise and like, okay, this is our position. It's XYZ. And the executive will go off and do a bunch of meetings and, you know, everybody nods their head at the crazy thing the CEO says. The CEO comes back and says, "Eureka, I've got it. We're going to be this other thing." And then poor marketers are like, "Wait a second, we just agreed on this thing. We're, you know, very organized, consistent." And so you get sort of this kind of herky jerkiness, which creates sort of dilution in your positioning and in your messaging, and your brand becomes inconsistent as a result.
So you've seen that at firsthand where, you know, as you said, it's all sort of nailed down apparently, and then someone will go off and maybe, you know, maybe one of the C-suite has a brainstorm overnight and comes back and says, no, it's not that, it's this. And that everyone has to then go down that route. So almost like, gosh, that's not really going to be very helpful.
Right.
Okay. I think
I'm not saying don't change your positioning. I'm saying do it deliberately and not sort of based on kind of one person's perception. I think a lot of times, you know, you get somebody really smart in the company and they're influential for a reason, but just because everybody's agreeing with them doesn't mean that what they're saying is the right thing. Your positioning needs to be something that not only the CEO can say, but also your newest salesperson or your least effective channel person, or maybe your customer in justification to their boss. So it needs to be something that's so simple, so clear, so consistent that everybody gets it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, certainly. Once you have it nailed down, it's no good just having some document and agreement. It has to be implemented. But let's go back to that question about, you know, when you ask marketeers, I think a lot of marketeers know what positioning is, but actually probably don't know how to do it properly. And I know that when I was reading April Dunford's book, really, it's her book is really for those people. It's we know what it is. And yes, she re-emphasizes the importance of it, but let me give you a blueprint to how to do it. And I found that quite useful in my own exercise there. So, why does a company need positioning?
Well, a couple things. First off, when buyers engage with you, they want assurance that what they're getting is really for them, is really exactly what they need.
Yeah.
They want to feel seen, right? They want this brand consistency, including consistent positioning. It helps them get there. There are reams of research showing that consistent brands are more valuable, like a third more valuable. And of course, if you just sort of look out there, you know, there's a glut of stuff. You know, the rule of thumb for message stickiness, which is related to positioning, is that you need to hear a message 7 times before you'll take action. Well, actually, these days it's more like 20 times. And if you're in B2B technology, where you know a finite number of buyers, you know, where thousands of companies are approaching a finite number of buyers and competing for their attention, it's even more. And of course, buyers are doing their own research. So you got to be crystal clear about what your positioning is so that they really have that assurance that what they see is what they're going to get.
Yeah, and actually, totally agree with that. And actually, it's if you don't get the position right, you're going to get the wrong messaging. And if you've got the wrong messaging, then you really are in trouble.
That's
so
true.
That is why, listeners, getting the positioning right and doing this exercise thoroughly with every buy-in, with buy-in from all groups within an organization is absolutely crucial. Now, having said that, if you go online and you type in positioning statement, you're going to probably come to something like a HubSpot page, and there's going to be a zip load of templates that you can download. Right.
Good including mine.
Good SEO. Good SEO. Yeah. What's your thoughts on these templates? I mean, obviously, we've all used them. We've all seen them, right? Should we use them? Is it a case of actually, a template just sort of assumes that you have the answers and you're literally just filling in these gaps? A bit like trying to put a script together if you're going to call some, has some value, maybe 10%. But should we be using these templates?
Oh, I absolutely think we should. Whatever you choose. And, there's a lot of similarity between them. So it's not like you have to make this big choice and go down this path. Mm-hmm. And also you can refine it or you can change templates. But the idea of having, sort of one source of truth, so that you are consistent with yourself and that everyone in your company is on the same page, is super important. I would also say there's something a little more fundamental about doing this exercise, which is writing something down really clarifies it for you and for people, for the people around you. Once you have that clarity, when you write something down, it just becomes so much more, it's so much easier for people to grok and to respond to. It also clarifies the why. So whatever positioning template you use, make sure that you take that. I like to think of it as the five whys approach, where you're asking why five times to really get to the crux of why you're doing something. Why are you positioning for a particular audience, or why are you positioning within a certain category, or why do you make claim X, Y, or Z? Really understanding the why underneath what you say is super important, because that is what convinces people to be in your boat with you and on message with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what you're saying is, listen, don't ignore them. Use them because they're a good frame of reference to start off with, but don't necessarily stick to, don't think you can't go outside of that box. Use it as a starter, right? Because there's a lot out there. Right? And you mentioned you've got one as well, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. We'll put a link to that in the podcast. Okay, so let's say I'm a co-founder in a cybersecurity startup, and we've got what we believe is a really cool product, and there's going to be huge demand for it. And you, Jamie, have been brought in to help and advise on positioning and obviously then the core messaging. Where do we start? What do we do?
We get our team together first off, and we're really clear on sort of who's doing what within the team. I think it's important to have, to really understand kind of who are my team members, who are my really key keepers of information, who are my naysayers, who are my, So I think doing a little bit of a lay of the land, both within your company and also externally, people who are maybe board members who have strong opinions, customers who are very involved, customer advisory board, et cetera. But I see it as three-part assessment. And the first is to really understand the competitive landscape, understand where you sit, what your competitors bring versus what you bring. What are the dynamics of that competitive market? Where is the market going? What could, come completely out of the blue and knock you and your competitors out, or obviate the need for you? So, really understanding your market and competitive landscape. The second is company. So really thinking about your internally, how do people perceive who you are and what you do and what value you bring to the table? And then the third part is customers. And I would really focus on existing and future customers. So not just people you serve today, but people you would like to serve. And I think that taking that five whys methodology, why do you use this? What else would you have used? What did this do for you? What would you do otherwise? What can you jettison or retire now that you're using this? Things like that to really get to the crux of the value that you bring to the table for them. The second thing about customers that I think is missed in a lot of in a lot of positioning exercises is that we don't watch them enough. We talk to them and we ask them questions, and maybe they do or don't understand what we're asking, and maybe they'll give us a good answer, maybe not, and we're going to look at it through our lens anyway. But I think one thing can be really revealing is to watch them work, whether they're working in your product or working in doing a like activity that your product helps to address. Watching them work is extremely revealing, and sort of asking them questions along the way. Why did you do this? Why did you go from this step to that step? Why did you skip that step? Really understanding what they're doing and the reasons why, the reasons behind them, what they're finding valuable, what they're finding not valuable, what they are, who is going to be the recipient of that work, and what are they concerned about, and are they going to be measured on this work? If so, what aspect of it? So really understanding them, their day, it's a little bit of a persona exercise, actually. And then just how they work. And okay. I think that those okay. three things, competitive, company, yeah. and customers.
Okay. Thanks for that. So I got that. I understand that. And I think one of the things you mentioned was, what would they say? We've got this new solution, this new product. Okay, we think it's great. Customer starts using it. But we'd say, well, what would you use if we weren't here? So that's an interesting. What are the competitive alternatives? Because what we might think are our competitors as this site is, we're going to be far more involved in knowing what those competitors than the customer. The customer's not going to know necessarily, right? Okay. The alternative to our solution could be the Excel spreadsheet, mm-hmm. right? Not as opposed to Joe Blogs down the road who we perceive as a customer. So I think, what are the competitive alternatives? What would they use if we didn't exist? That was Matt, I picked that up from the points that you made there. But I suppose another question, Jamie, is what if we're a startup, we don't have customers to watch? We've got this fantastic new idea. It's innovative. It's breaking into new territory. As a co-founder, I'm thinking, no, there's no existing market category. We've got a new solution.
Right.
But there's no frame of reference. It's not like I'm saying, yes, this is an identity security piece of software or an edge computer firewall. I'm saying, no, this is a new problem. And that's a problem in itself, isn't it? Because we don't have.
Yes and no.
Do you think so? Do you? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, yes and no. So, for example, one of the companies that I advise is called DAZZ, D-A-Z-Z, and they're early stage cybersecurity company. They just announced their A round of funding. And I would argue that they're a little bit in that space of there are no, they're sort of forging a new category of basically, if you think of cloud security as being two things, finding problems and fixing them, lots and lots of companies are focused on the finding and they're focused on the fixing. And one of the things that they did, and kind of coming back to this whole notion of watching customers, before ever even conceiving of what the product should be, they watched dozens and dozens of customers work. Work meaning, look at what the security, cloud security queue was of issues and alerts that had been sort of surfaced by a lot of these detection tools that they were using, and then how do they resolve them in the development process, and kind of watching them sort of become frustrated because the backlog was growing so much because of all these wonderful detections and all this great innovation in the cloud security market, but really that had created this sort of glut of alerts that they would never, ever be able to get through. So I would say that even without a product, you can watch customers work. I mean, obviously you need to find a way to earn their trust to get to sit down with them and do this exercise. Mm-hmm. But my goodness, it's informative because it really, it helped them, it really revealed to them what they need to do and what their roadmap needs to look like.
No, got that. I mean, I totally understand that. But I think I suppose my point was, look, if, is it Daz? Is that how you pronounce it? Daz have got this, as you said, they're looking at the fix as opposed to the find. Mm-hmm. And they're finding their solution is going to take a pain point away from prospective customers. But the challenge there is, if it's a new category, i.e., do they perceive, have they got any competitors in the space?
I mean, yes, but not really sort of hard and fast. It's a newish category.
Okay.
Because honestly, it's a category that sort of, you know, came about because of the success of an adjacent category.
Gotcha.
Of cloud security detection, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And would that category, is the category that they perceive to be in, is that covered by the analysts, like, for example, the Gartner?
Yeah, it kind of sits across multiple categories.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. No, I got it. So I suppose my question there is, because customers look for a frame of reference to be able to compare your solution to what they perceive are the problems out there. And mm-hmm. by having a category, I think that does help. And I think, I was listening to an interview with, I think it's David Cantle, who's the CEO of Drift. And he, they've created a new category, right? But his advice was don't bother. He said, don't try it. He said, it took us $10 million to do it. It's extremely difficult to do.
Right.
So the best thing to do is find an existing category and find a subcategory within that that you can piggyback off and leverage. So I thought that was interesting.
It is wonderful, actually, that advice, and I would agree with it 100%. In fact, I think category creation as an exercise is dumb. Like, it's something that you don't kind of set out to do. It happens as a result of the good work that you've done. And so whether you are forging a new category or you're slicing off a segment of the existing category, or you're going into a category that's a little bit old and sort of redefining what the requirements should be in that category, kind of regardless of what you do, it almost doesn't matter. It's like, do the good work of positioning, and the category creation or category redefinition will follow. And I'm always very skeptical when I see people with like category creator, category designer in their bio, because it's like, okay, but do the work.
Yeah, do the work. Good advice. Okay, so a startup's not going to have a lot of customers, right? If sometimes none, obviously, because they've been developing this product. So they've got no one to watch necessarily who's using their product per se. So if you were advising me, and I'm in this new startup, and we've got Series A funding, and we're ready to go, but clearly, if we now don't position this product well, we get the wrong messaging, we could be wasting a lot of time and resource, and we don't have that necessarily. So yeah, we get the team together, but if we can't watch them, how do we replace that? Do we literally say, okay, well, we need to get this product out in a diverse a sort of ecosystem of potential clients, and really just give it to a lot of different people to then watch and work out. Because you're not going to necessarily, if you do work out positioning day one, the chances are for being correct in 12 months' time is pretty slim. It's going to change. Would you not agree?
I would. My mind is still kind of caught circling around, well, if you can't watch. And I would argue that, if you're a Series A company and you can't get access to your key users to interview them in depth, including watching them do some portion of their work, then you're not doing the work that you need to do. That said, I do think there is an iterative nature to that exercise. And I do, I love the idea of prototypes or even really sort of in-depth mocks, mock-ups can help. But early prototypes or very bare bones MVP, products, beta products, alpha products, beta products, like all of that, I think is very useful. It helps people have like no time to think about what you are doing. They only have that bit of time for you, that sort of hour. And, So the more that you can do to help them sort of get there, you know, reduce their cognitive load, explain to them very quickly and crisply what you do, and then have you see something that you can respond to, and really do the work ahead of time to sort of understand what do I need to get from that customer? Because a lot of times that customer, that sort of early prospect will, they want to be nice. They'll tell you what you want to hear, you know? Mm-hmm. So really like, sharpening your, Q&A to elicit the response that is going to be informative to you.
I think the way that you ask the questions, and I do take on point the point you mentioned about, if you're a Series A, if you're not in that situation where you've got people who were testing or even paying clients, then that's probably not a good. And maybe I should say, well, let me see, an early stage seed financing, etc. But okay, I got that. You know, with the companies that you've had experience with, and the founders and the marketing teams, do you find that people talk a lot about features, but very poor at mapping the value to the customers? Mm-hmm. And really that's what the customers are interested in, which is going to dictate the positioning, as opposed to, you know, this is our feature, this is what we do, this is compared. Mm-hmm. Do you find that? Is that a common problem?
I do think it's a common problem, and it's particularly difficult in the more techie you are in B2B technology, the more it's a problem, because you're toggling between two modes. One, needing to kind of tell that higher level emotional benefit, which I think a lot of technologists roll their eyes at, honestly. But also being so far down in the weeds on features, where you sort of like say the feature and then just assume that the customer, who is already very techie, really understands that feature. So it's a little bit of a, you know, you're sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. That's why B2B marketing is hard. I think it's harder than any other kind of marketing. And, you know, we fail a lot because of it. So I think that the way to do it is sort of thinking about it as an onion, where you have that high level. And I like to think of it not a feature necessarily, but a capability. So that benefit is wrapped into the feature a little bit, right? So it's rather than we have this whoozy-wazzits thing that you don't really understand. It helps you map your network. Oh, okay. I get that. I can map my network. Okay. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's a little bit, the benefit is wrapped into the feature.
Yeah. An example I read about was, let's say, cameras on a smartphone, you've got a 15 megapixel camera. So it's a feature, right? But the real value, I mean, most people aren't interested in that. They wouldn't know whether it's 35 people. They're interested in the fact that actually what that means is the photos are going to be really sharp when they're printed or they're zoomed in. And it's about
mapping. I can see the rosettes on the leopard from a mile away. Okay, well, that I get. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's about the features that enable the benefits, which then get translated into the value in the unique customer terms, but it have to be in the terms that the customer understands, right?
Okay.
Okay. So we've got, let's say we've done that. We understand what the value is of what the product delivers versus, let's say, the alternatives. Then I think the challenge is, okay, so who cares about that? Which set of customers are really going to be appreciative of the fact, let's say, that they can zoom in on the leopard and really see in detail? And how do you find those best fit customers? Because that's part of the challenge here, right?
Right. And I think that's the crux of positioning, because you don't want everybody. Because if you try to go after too broad a market, you will end up wasting your time, your sales people's time, your money. You know, you want to, if you think about your pipeline, you know, anything stage two or three and beyond, like you don't want a 50% opportunity or a 20% opportunity, a 30% opportunity. You want like the 80%ers. If you have confidence, if you have reasonable confidence that those people are out there, don't you want the vast majority of your pipeline to be represented by those 80%ers? You know, so if you can do it, do it.
Yeah. Well, I think you've got to work out how you do it, right? Because if you're a startup and you've got finite resources, you really want to be targeting as narrowly as you can to meet the near-term sales objectives, right? And you can broaden out that target later. I.e., you want to be having a very clear idea of who that target customer is that really does appreciate the lens on that camera, as opposed to someone who doesn't necessarily. And then you want to be able, and then as you penetrate that market and you prove or disprove that assumption, you can then broaden the targets later. Would that be about right?
I think so. And I think there are four things that you need to have that you can really slice away the folks that don't matter and really home in on the folks that do. And that is, your positioning is about them. It's distinctive. It hits a nerve and it's super consistent.
So let's just go over that. So it's about them. It's consistent.
It's about them. It tells them who they are.
Yeah.
Or it signals who they are.
Yeah.
It's distinctive. It hits a nerve,
yeah.
You know, by maybe describing the problem in a compelling way, mm-hmm. you know, and it's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So every interaction that you have, mm-hmm. you know exactly who it is you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we walk down the high street or down your local shops, where we're getting this messaging that's based on some sort of positioning in someone's boardroom, right? It started off there. What companies stand out to you, Jamie, that, wow, these guys are nailing it all the time. They've got their positioning dead on. And actually, we can learn from that. Are there any particular examples?
Yeah, there are a few examples I think that stand out. First is a recent in the news, non-company, but I'll just give you a sort of what I think is sort of a clever example. And that is Vladimir Putin. Right now, he's got troops lined up on the Ukraine border, mm-hmm. and guess what he's doing? He's not saying, "Hey, I want Ukraine. Hey, Crimea was the right thing to do." He's not saying any of that. You know what he's saying? He's saying NATO is coming after me. You know, if you Google Putin and NATO, just even today, I did this just kind of thinking about what are some non-company positioning examples. Mm-hmm. You know, you get headlines like Putin warns NATO of military response to alliance and expansion, or Putin warns of possible military response over aggressive NATO. So he's doing a great job, I think, of positioning, mm-hmm. NATO as being the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of he's just responding, you know. So, if you want like a pretty egregious example of positioning, I think you have it right there on the front page of your newspaper. But to kind of get back to what we're about, B2B, and I think there are three companies that I'll kind of just share with you quickly. And I think they do a very good job of this, and I'll tell you why. So the first one is Figma. And, the message on the front of their website says nothing great is ever brainstormed alone. And then the word brainstorm changed, brainstorm designed, made alone. So the idea is that there's this collaboration team that is working on design. And even just the way that you feel when you come onto the website, it's like you're being dropped into a mid-process design session. And so if you think about kind of what's the problem is that creative teams have this sort of, you know, they do all this brainstorming. It's really great. Come up with mood boards and colors and da, da, da. And then the person who is doing the actual design work goes off for a few days or a week and sort of doesn't come back. So it's like, it's this really kind of herky jerky process. Whereas if you're in Figma, you are collaborating real time as a team. And so it really gets to, you know, kind of going back to that framework of it's about about them. It's distinctive. It hits a nerve and consistent. So it's like it hits a nerve, right? Because the nerve is, oh my God, this problem is pretty significant. And in this day and age, when we need to move really, really quickly, we can't have somebody go off and work in the Adobe suite for a week. You know, we need to know now if this design is going to work. So, you know, and it's about them. It talks mm-hmm. about being that creative team designing together. The second one is Asana, and their tagline or the line on their website, work on big ideas without the busy work. So it's about, you know, when you think about kind of project management, oh my God, it's a pain in the rear, and you've got to get, you know, some poor person to do the project managing in the, you know, in the spreadsheet or the app. And it's a pain, but if, you know, at least what they claim, it's like in Asana, it's actually additive to you. And it's so easy to use and so collaborative that it frees up your mental space to work on those big ideas. They're sort of declaring war on work about work. And then the third one is Pendo, except it's not the recent Pendo. There was some work that they did a while back, and they subsequently kind of changed. And I think as they just kind of grew and got bigger and needed to do more with their message, but maybe a year ago, they were very, very consistent and sharp with their message. And that was, they defined something called the product cloud for product-led people. And the way that they sort of, it was like the beloved product cloud for product-led people. And so they were defining this sort of aspirational who, the people who are using this are product-led. Of course, not everybody who's using Pendo is product-led, but man, they aspire to be. So I thought that did a really good job of sort of naming who, you know, that about them, the notion of being about them. I thought Pendo did a really good job of that.
Thanks for those. So there's two, there's Figma, Asana, and Pendo. So, and you've come to those conclusions through your experience, but also largely, as you said, you went to their website and it was very clear. Mm-hmm. Not only their messaging was clear, which means that the positioning has right. been done to in mm-hmm. order for that messaging to resonate with you. And that's what we want, isn't it? That's what you want. What you've just said about those three brands, you want your companies that you're involved in on the board for people, when they go to their website, to have the same reaction.
Right.
And to do that.
And to be clear, I don't know these companies really well. I mean, these are just like, so if I can go as a person who's, you know, I'm not associated with them, I don't work for them, I'm not on their board. So like, if I can go to their website and pick that up, exactly who it's for, exactly what that position is, that distinctive, you know, that problem, man, you know, they've, it feels to me like they've nailed it.
No, definitely. Absolutely. Well, no, what I meant by that when I was talking is that it's obviously what you would like to is for the companies that you work with, for people who are visiting their website subsequently to have the same reaction as you have when you visited Asana, i.e. it right. really sings to them, right? That, obviously not everybody who goes to Asana's website is going to feel like you have, but you've been involved with project management, you realize what a pain in the butt it is. You realize there's hundreds of solutions that are purporting to do the same thing. But Asana's resonated with you because it's appealed to you a particular way in a messaging, which is the foundation to that is the positioning. So someone in that team at Asana, probably through trial and error, through trying to work out who their best fit customers are, through, as you said, watching. And in project management, that's what they do, isn't it? They will be able to tell the analytics behind that project management exactly how people are interacting and engaging with the product. And with software, right. it's a lot easier to do than perhaps some other products. So, yeah, I found that's really good. Thank you for that. So one last question on positioning is, what advice would you give that's going to help perhaps our listeners and you see as being quite often as a pitfall that people fall down? And actually, if they knew X, then perhaps they wouldn't do it. They might really think twice about doing it. Is there any piece of advice that you've got?
Yeah, there's sort of two pieces of advice. And this is kind of, I think, a little bit checklisty. So mm-hmm. bear with me. The first one is, as you're thinking about your position in the market, which is like the precursor to positioning, think about these three things. One, their customer need. you know, what is that need that the customer has? The two is the white space, like what is not taken or not well, not well addressed. And then the third one is what uniquely do you bring to the table? What is sort of your unique value? And if you can get to the intersection of those, you'll understand what your position is, I believe. The second piece of advice is, as you're articulating your position, really think about it as three things. One, the differentiator that you bring. Two, your category, or the category, the definitional category that you are playing in. And then the third is the aspirational who. And I would emphasize the aspirational who, the who you're for. You know, with Figma, it's the you know, collaborative creative teams, and Pendo, it's product-led people. So really thinking about kind of who you're for and calling that out, because I think it can help create sort of a cognitive, it's almost like a shortcut for people, like, ah, that is for me. That is why that resonates with me, because I am seen, I am called out in this positioning message.
And that is exactly what this is about, isn't it? It's about getting to that point where you've given those three points, and going through that exercise. And that's where we want to be. You want to be where someone goes, yeah, that's for me. That's for me. And then you can charge a premium for it, because they've decided, I need to have this. This is not, you know, this is not one of those things I might have. This is a must have. Okay, really good, really good. Okay, a couple of quick fire questions, Jenny. Tell me, along your journey, what have been the best resources that have helped you?
Oh, this is a boring one, but Google, man, because like, I don't know if you do this, but when I love to cook, and so when I and I love cookbooks, and so I have all these like really lovely, you know, big, fancy, beautiful, it's like food porn. And anytime I cook a recipe, I don't just cook the recipe from the cookbook. Like I will cross reference and look up five or six different versions or variations of that recipe online. And similarly with marketing, if I'm about to like think about a category or come up with a message, like I will cross check the hell out of it with just by using Google. So that's my biggest resource. You know, that said, I do have a couple of, you know, well, one, which was sort of a precursor to the April Dunsford book that you love, and I think is also really good. And she mentions it in her book, and that is an old book called Positioning. I think it's called Positioning the Battle for Your Mind by Al Ries and Jack Trout. Mm-hmm. If you've read that,
yeah,
like,
she did mention that. Yes.
Yeah. I read that. Really? Uh-huh. Yeah. Cause my parents were in, you know, in marketing. And so, uh-huh. You know,
you'd recommend that?
I would. I think it's still relevant today, and just a great sort of foundation. In fact, I might read it even before, you know, even before the April Dunsford book. And then another thing that I love getting positioning ideas from, and just sort of the honing arguments, is any kind of you know, legal or Supreme Court. You know, just because I love politics and government. And so I'm always reading, like, you know, the dissent from Sonia Sotomayor or somebody like that, and who is one of our Supreme Court justices. I think that the argumentation and the logic is so fine, is so delightfully clear and crisp. It's just a great exercise in understanding how to bring someone through the logic of an argument. So I would urge every marketer to go through at some point and read, whether it's a Supreme Court opinion or a dissent. Just legal argumentation is I think one of the closest, best things to a great argument laid out so logically.
Well, that's curious for me, because when you think of legal papers coming out of a court, you think of reams of documents, and you just think, you look at them and they're literally wads of documents, documentation, and you think, where's the where's the conciseness there? And yet what you're saying is there is a side to it where the brevity, the clarity, and the articulation of the word means that it's the economy of words, but just so clear, which for me is the opposite of what I perceive when I don't get involved in massive sort of legal documents. But that's really interesting.
The T's and C's. No, I'm talking, you know, and maybe even start from the bottom up in some of these, opinions, but like just, I don't know, the sort of legal reason, the rational, logical reasoning, it just is a great discipline too, because what it does for you is then it helps you apply to your own, whether it is a product you're trying to, if you say my product is X, Y, and Z, where X, Y, and Z are the benefits, really think through like, well, why is that a benefit and why does it matter? And how do I prove that? And if I prove it with this data set, what exactly do I need to prove? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that kind of thinking is very disciplined and is like beyond reproach. But to get there, I think you have to just have this exquisite like clarity of thought. And the only other time I've seen that kind of thinking is in a legal brief or a,
That's interesting. I'm going to follow you up after, Jamie, and ask you, please send me that one that you're referring to. So I really would like to see it because I'm fascinated with that as well. Now, I know from your LinkedIn profile, you describe yourself as a diehard Monty Python fan. Okay. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
Now, if you were on a desert island and you could only have one Monty Python film or sketch, what would it be and why?
Oh, I guess the Holy Grail, just because it's brilliant and, I don't know. to be honest, like there are two kinds of people in the world, Monty Python fans and people I would rather not associate with.
Yes, I was looking, funny enough, because I was looking at some, I'd read that one, and I thought, yeah, I do like Monty Python. I must dig out a few sketches. And I went in and watched the argument sketch again.
You're merely contradicting me.
And I just thought,
I'm sorry, this is abuse.
Yeah, brilliant. So if you haven't seen that, listeners, just type in argument sketch Monty Python and you'll know what we're referring to. And as Jamie said, you'll either love it or you'll hate it. And it's Marmite, right? Do you understand the expression Marmite, Jamie?
It's a food, yes?
Yeah, it's like a yeast spread, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's global or certainly in the UK it's popular. And as a kid, I had it, Marmite on toast. And, we use this as an expression. If someone says, that's Marmite, they're not talking necessarily about the food. They're talking, people either love it or hate it. And Monty Python is Marmite, right? And let's not talk about the life of Brian because we'll be here all day, but that was a class.
Absolutely.
Jamie, with your experience and you've been at the coalface, the B2B coalface, many years marketing, and you've now, as I mentioned right at the beginning, board advisor and of many high growth tech startups. So you really have got that experience. So thank you for sharing with us today a topic which I believe is fundamental. As you said, it's the foundational to marketing. It is where our messaging comes from. And we have to work on it. We have to work hard on it. And we have to continually learn. And so by talking to people who've been there and done it, that's great. By reading books and just continually learning. The expression here is never stop learning. So thank you so much for that today and being my guest. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Before we wrap up, would you tell people where they can find out more about you and how to get in touch?
Oh, I'm at on Twitter at Jamie C. Barnett, JamieCBarnett. LinkedIn, very easy to find me, and on Medium. So just Jamie Barnett on Medium.
Perfect, and that's Barnett with double T at the end. Excellent. Thanks again, Jamie, and thank you to all our listeners. Have a fabulous day, and as we say here, Never Stop Learning. See you on the next episode.
Thanks again for joining me on B2B Uncovered. If you liked this episode, then please hit the subscribe button. Want to go the full hog? Hey, yeah, I'd love a rating from you. Just tap the number of stars that you'd like to give us. As we're just getting going, that's going to help tremendously. Thank you.